my ideas come at an awkward hour of the day when the right amount of caffeine and conversations and poor diet have all kind of mixed in this one zone, things just start happening. It's never when I want them to happen, but they just start coming from somewhere I can't explain, and I never ignore them when they do.
Welcome to the Idea Generation Podcast, a show about creative entrepreneurship. My name is Noah Callahan Bever, and each week we'll be speaking with some of the most innovative ideators in culture and trying to figure out how they make their creative decisions. This podcast is brought to you by the good people at Shopify. Feeling that entrepreneurial itch? Turn your passion into a business with Shopify. They've got everything you need to start, run, or grow your business. Check out shopify.com/idea to learn more. Kenny Beats always had a passion for music, and there was never a doubt in his mind that he would turn it into a profession. However, his path to making music a career had its own twists and turns, including an EDM phase and, at the time unwanted, but in the long run beneficial, stint at the Berklee School of Music. Thanks, Mom. But through it all, Kenny kept working, kept sharpening his skills, and kept discovering how to craft a sound that he was proud of, one beat at a time.
I was an only child, and both my parents worked. My dad worked two jobs when I was a kid, and my mom worked like 8 to 6 type of hours. So I had a lot of time by myself. I had a lot of time to figure out what interests me as a kid. Like, I was in after school programs and stuff when I was younger, but then by middle school, I was just like at the crib and I played guitar. And then I was on the computer so much, just like talking to my friends or doing whatever, playing games, that it was like, how do I just make music on the computer? And it slowly just became a thing where, like, didn't matter if my parents were home or what they were doing, what was going on. Like, I was just always making music all the time. And I was kind of stoked on the days where they had to work a little longer, because it's like extra hour of drums. Like, I could turn the amp up for a little longer. But my parents both worked super hard to just make sure that we were cool.
What kind of jobs did they have?
My dad worked in restaurants for a lot when I was a kid, like ran a steakhouse for a while. And then he started working in like installing systems in people's houses that do like smart home shit, like TVs and this and that. And my mom was a private contractor. She like builds people's houses. And yeah, they both like loved music in a way that I felt like, even me being 6'7" and playing basketball or like getting really good grades or whatever, I couldn't get as much of a reaction out of my parents as if I played something really good in guitar. Or if I did something musically, that's kind of, even with my dad having played basketball and this and that, music is what I got a reaction out of them with. So I feel like that made me want to get good at it. And my parents just worked really hard and were home when they could be home. So like, I couldn't really make as much noise as I wanted living in apartments and stuff when I grew up. And like, I really cherished the time my dad gave me whenever he was exhausted coming home from working two shifts or whatever it was, to just let me play drums in a tiny garage apartment living room.
Your dad was a fairly accomplished basketball player. Did any of that inform how you thought about competition or any other parts of life?
I think it's almost what you and I were talking about shooting in the gym. I've seen my dad shoot a million jump shots. I've seen my dad on so many Saturdays and Sundays when I was a kid, after he worked all damn week, like go to the YMCA, and I would just sit there with like action figures at 4 years old, and my dad would shoot 1,000 free throws. And to this day, with a broken back and cancer and every ailment you can imagine, is like late 60s, my dad will still go 8 for 10. I'm not kidding you. It's unbelievable. Like, something about all those hours my dad spent doing the thing he loved, it always gave me this bar for how bad do I want something. And because my dad was so good at basketball, and I played in high school, and you know what I mean? I played varsity. I did all this stuff, but like, I always felt like I never worked as hard as my dad worked, because he was so good at basketball. And my dad grew up super broke and with nothing, got a full ride to college. And that was almost as impressive to me as any of his statistics. And I feel like I still kind of think about that to this day, of just what's the difference between when I work 9 to 5, 5 days a week, and when I go 14 hours a day for a month. And that's from 25 to 30, when I really started gunning it and I really started shooting 1,000 shots a day, my career went completely different. And I think when I was younger till 25, I always would think about the hard work that my pops did to get where he got, whether it was basketball or just taking care of me or whatever it was. And I would think, yeah, maybe that's not for me, or I got to just find my thing. Da, da, da. I've known what my thing is, whatever. I was just coasting. I decided to stop coasting at a certain age. And I think my dad just loved basketball so much. At a young age, he decided to just shoot 1,000 fucking jump shots a day. And I wish I could teach that to anybody younger than me doing anything. You know what I mean? Like, those parties are going to be there. Those people to date are going to be there. Like, you go spend that time doing it now when you're 19, when you're 21, when you're 24. When you're my age, you're going to be way farther than I am, you know? Like,
was there anyone in your life that sort of opened your eyes to the possibilities of pursuing creativity as a craft that could pay for your life?
I grew up in Connecticut. Like, music and culture surrounding music and these things did not exist. People can say whatever they want about what goes on now in the tri-state area, but for me to get around a studio or an artist or anything, I had to go to New York City. I had to leave where I was from and to go pursue this other thing. Creativity was not in front of me all the time. There wasn't people in my high school playing instruments and making beats. Like, my friends would look at my Kenny Beats MySpace at 15 years old and be like, you should be playing basketball. Like, we all wish we were your height and you're making beats. Like, what are you doing? So the first time I remember thinking it was possible was someone who's my friend now, Anthony Perino. He's a producer named Elite. He works really closely with J. Cole. He produced Ari Lennox's last album. Anthony went to my high school and he had done a beat for Jadakiss. And he was years older than me and he was out of the school now. But someone told me, this one guy who went to your school one time did this one beat. And that was enough for me, because it means, oh, okay, he made it. He figured out how to get around Rough Riders and how to get around all these other people and do all this stuff. I can do it too. And I didn't think about money. I didn't think about, like, am I going to be able to make what all these kids who have hedge fund parents? And I think it wasn't until way later where I started understanding, like, the pitfalls of the music industry financially and how to move better and how to create value around myself and selling my music and this and that. That stuff came way later. Like, the monetary value was never a part of the beginning of me wanting to be creative or make music, because no one around me was doing it. I just needed someone to let me know I could do it and I'll figure the money out.
What was the inspiration that made you pick up the guitar when you're 9 years old and start playing?
I knew I wanted to do music. My mom was always like, you're going to be on a soccer team. You're going to be on the baseball team. And I played every sport as a kid. And I just was always like, please just get me a guitar. Give me a bass. Give me anything. And my dad's best friend, took me to Manny's in the city on 48th, bought me a guitar, took me to Michael Jordan's Steakhouse in Grand Central, bought me a steak. Yeah. Best day of my life, changed my whole life. I started playing guitar that night, never stopped.
What were you listening to at that time?
With my friends, probably like G-Unit, and then at home, like Willie Nelson, Sade, fucking any classic rock you can think of. My dad was very eclectic. So I kind of had the stuff that all my friends sang and all my friends liked and what's on TRL and what's going on MTV or whatever. And then I had my dad playing these cassettes, playing all these tapes, playing all these different songs that he loved. And even though he's this basketball guy, music's what my dad loves. My dad to this day has thousands of vinyls and cassettes and all this stuff. And I feel like that made me want to play like a Bonnie Raitt song on drums and then go play like a Fleetwood Mac song on drums and then play a Sly song and then listen to a D'Angelo song, because my dad liked The Chronic as much as he liked fucking Whitney Houston. You know what I mean? So when I started playing instruments, when I would play guitar, it wasn't like, all right, I didn't have a guitar teacher. I didn't have anything. I would just try to play songs that my dad liked.
So how are you learning?
Tabs. If you just search guitar tab, any song, it would come up and it would say this string, this number on the fret. And I'll go, okay, fifth string, fifth fret. And I would figure out a chord over a half hour and then slowly play to the song, play to the song, play to the song. And my dad would sit there after work and listen to me suck at guitar so loud. And that was how I formed my musical mind. That's how I started playing instruments.
And at what point did you sort of take what you're learning here, listening to these records with your father, and start thinking about applying it to the music that you're listening to with your friends?
probably not till after Berkeley.
Really?
I wasn't even playing guitar on my beats till I was like 24. And I played guitar since I was 9. Made beats since I was 15. The idea of even like crossing those worlds of like instruments and 808s. It was like the same thing with my friends. My friends didn't know I played guitar. Like I wouldn't talk about it. It wasn't cool to them. Like it was never like you would get the reaction from like girls at school or my homies being like, oh, that's dope. It wasn't that. They were like, let's go play sports. Like let's play video games. So I kind of kept these worlds separate. And then it got to be me being in studios at 19, 20, whatever. And I'd pick up a guitar and play a guitar. And someone would be like, you play guitar? And I'm like, yeah, but like, I'm not about to play you a Led Zeppelin song. Like no one cares, you know? And then everybody started telling me, you should be playing on your beats. You should be incorporating this stuff. And then I would play songs I learned from my dad. I'd talk about something that I used to listen to with him. And someone would be like, that Sade thing is my favorite record of all time. And I know every word of that song. I know every drum beat and I know the bass part and I know the guitar part. And I started realizing my dad and my parents is playing music, put me through school. And whenever I used to think, how could I make the best beat that sounds like the radio? Or how could I make something that my friends are going to think sounds hot? Sounds like something Pharrell would do. Never worked. When I started just being myself and like living all these influences in my music, people started saying, that's crazy. That sounds awesome. This is your sound. So it took me so long to realize that like, it's all music. It doesn't have to be the new cool stuff. And then like the jazz and all the secret stuff you're not supposed to say you like, it's all cool. And people who do music make you feel like it's all cool. But I didn't grow up around people who did music. Once I'm 18, 20, 21, I'm having 5 friends who produce, 10 friends who produce, 20 people on MySpace that I'm DMing. My network of creatives was like nothing. And I think that's what I relate to people on now. Talk to kids. I was talking to a kid last night in my Discord from Arkansas. And he's like, Kenny, like I make all these beats. I do all this stuff. How do I get around people? How do I start, you know what I mean? Just doing stuff. And I try to tell them, like, I always felt like I was so far out of the loop, you know what I mean? That I understand those kids now who are in the middle of nowhere and want to be a part of the scene, but don't have a way in. I feel like I was just trying to find any way in I could.
So how did you make the leap from playing guitar, messing around with live drum kits, to getting on a drum machine and starting to make beats?
I took an after-school breakdancing class when I was 11 years old. And this kid from the high school, who's still my friend, Max, and I was talking to him one day, and he was playing some Dr. Dre song, and he goes, you know, Dr. Dre plays all the drums and does all the raps. And I was like, what do you mean plays the drums? And he meant like he made the beat, but he's 15 and I'm 11, you know what I mean? And he's explaining to me while I'm doing like a handstand on my fucking head or trying to like pop lock. And I swear, like when I think about that moment now, it thinks it's like a scene in the Matrix or something. It's like a lightning bolt like connected in my brain. I was like, there's people who make the music. That's fucking, I never thought about that. You just think about the singer. As like a young kid or whatever, I was always just like, oh, that person sings the song. It's their song. I never thought about like, there's someone for the person who's not in a band who has to play the instruments. If you're in a band, obviously a guitar player or whatever, but like on a Whitney Houston song, who's playing the drums? And he said that about Dr. Dre. And I was like, whoa. And I didn't think like, I want to be a producer. I want to do that. But it just opened my mind up to like, people do that. And then as years went by, guitar, like I said, wasn't impressing my friends. And so I started trying to make beats. And I remember playing my one friend this like shitty beat where I had completely stolen from this Timbo video. Timbo did this beat for Brandy. And I'd stole the whole beat and remade it in GarageBand. And my friends were the most impressed with me they'd ever been. There's no dunk in high school or like me dating any cool hot girl or anything that ever impressed my homies as much as this one beat where I ripped off Timbo.
Did they know that you ripped off Timbo?
No. No, this is a Brandy. What do you mean? This kid's from Connecticut. I'm literally like playing them this beat that I stole verbatim. And everyone's like, you made this? That was enough right there. That made me go, I need to make beats. To this day, my barometer is that my friends love it. If I can go to one of my friends and play them a song and they freak out that I did that beat, I'm working with that artist, something that happens in the song, that makes me still have the most adrenaline, not Twitter engagement. I was in this weird kind of like middle zone between producers who were sampling off vinyl and old drum breaks and hard 90s kind of beats. And I was born in 91. By the time popular music in the early 2000s is happening and you're hearing Pharrell and Timbo and things off of a Korg keyboard or a Yamaha motif or things through an MPC that aren't samples from a James Brown record, but are actually like drum samples, there was an even bigger learning curve than there was for maybe producers 10 years older than me. Because at least then you could maybe find the record. Mm-hmm. You could maybe find the snare that Primo used or whatever, because you just happened to dig and find the right record that day. But for me, whenever I would hear a clip song or I'd hear something with like even Justin Timberlake or whatever, I'd be like, where's that snare? There wasn't the places on the internet now where you can just go find the drums. You couldn't even buy them. Loopmasters and these places where you could buy drum kits came later. You had to network just to get drums that were of like semi-professional level. And MySpace was kind of what Reddit and Discord and all these things are now, where I was messaging Hit-Boy at 16 years old with my beat. He had like a Pussycat Dolls placement and was like working with Polo the Don and stuff. And I was literally messaging Hit-Boy and Chasing Cash nonstop, trying to just get them to hear my beats. And Chase and him both would respond and be like, your ideas are cool, your drums are trash. And I remember like being like, oh, he's right. A couple months later, someone sent me a kit and I heard a snare in that kit that I knew from some Fabulous song. And I was like, oh my God. And it was like that. You had to meet somebody just to get something that was of the quality. Now it's the opposite. Now you can get anything. If a song from Uzi comes out yesterday, the snare is on Reddit tomorrow for free. The technology back then was like the beginning of what's happening now. We're making beats on a laptop with drum samples and even samples that are from YouTube instead of vinyl or from an MP3 instead of an old cassette. And now that's still what's going on, but that was new when I was 15. So these kids who are 15 now look at me and they're like, I'm the elder statesman of current production. That's why my Twitch or The Cave or whatever, I'm making beats just like kids who are making beats for Cardi and Yeat and Uzi and the youngest, coolest producers, the Nick Miras who did the Juice WRLD stuff. Like, I'm making beats the same way they are, but at the same token, I'm talking to people who work on Amy Winehouse songs and figuring out how they got their stuff together. I'm still searching for sounds now in a different way, but the technology like evolving has made it so easy now for kids to jump that learning curve. And someone could take what those 5 years took me and learn it on YouTube and Reddit and Discord in a month.
While Kenny knew that he wanted to produce music, he also knew that he was a long way from earning the opportunity to get in the studio with an established artist. Fortunately, he finessed a connection to Johnny Shipes, CEO of the Cinematic Music Group, and scored an internship that would bring him a lot closer. On days where Johnny didn't have work for the eager high school student, he would send Kenny to music mogul Dame Dash's DD172 space to soak up the vibes. Prior to going to school, you start to meet people in the real music industry, Johnny Shipes in particular. How are you even making these introductions or getting into these circles?
There was a producer who, my same friend Max, who had known me since I was 11. Max introduced me to this producer he was friends with. And he had gone to my high school at one point, and he was now producing for Snoop and working with Ryan Leslie and out in LA doing all these big sessions. And he wanted to introduce me to him. His name is Alex Sanzo. Alex just took me under his wing. He had this little shitty red BMW that was super old, and we would get in it and he would drive me to the city every day. And we go to the studio on 48th where they would give him studio time, which was actually run by Austin Rosen, who manages Post. Okay. And I would go to the studio anytime I could, after work, after school, whenever Alex would pick me up, I'd go with Alex to the studio. And some days I didn't press a single button. I was basically his runner. And other days him and I would make beats together. But I met Nipsey in that studio. I met Currency in that studio. I met Johnny Shipes, who I would intern for, in that studio. I met French Montana in that studio. And this is me at 17, 18 years old. All these people aren't meeting me as a producer. They're not meeting me as a peer. They're not all dapping me up and taking my number, but I'm around it. And like I'm saying, for someone who comes from a place where there's no studios, culture, music, anything, just being in the same room as a rapper you like was, like I said, more than I needed to keep going for the next 9 months. And so I started just being around people. And at the time, Twitter and social media was so different. The biggest artist on Twitter might have 100K whenever I got my Twitter, 2009. the biggest managers are rocking 5K, 6K followers. You know what I mean? I would go to these managers and these ancillary people who I would see that were always tagged by the artists or always in the pictures with the artists. And I would hit them up and say, do you need any help? Is there anything I can do? I sell weed. I make beats. Is there anything that you need? And Johnny Currency, Smoke Dizza, these guys had been doing tours together, putting out videos together. And I was just always following Johnny because I thought he was like the funniest manager. And I hit Johnny in the DMs and I just said, is there anything I can do? And he gave me an address, met them there the next day, brought all my beats, all my weed, all my resume points with me. And that night I got a placement for a song called Continental Kush Breakfast with Smoke Dizza. And then Johnny said, yeah, you're my intern now. And I was his first intern. The next day I went to Big Crit's first XXL interview with Rob Markman, who now does everything with Genius and everything, my guy. And the next day was something, the next day was something. And all these people that I met that first week, I know now. We're still cool. You know what I mean? And they remember me being snot-nosed and being 17, and now I'm 30, here talking to you, here doing whatever. And those relationships have lasted this long. I just needed someone to give me that start. And thank God for Alex. He's the first person to start taking me to studios.
And all of this was unpaid, I assume?
Completely unpaid. Yeah. My mom got real mad at me because I was losing money interning and going to the city so much, just paying for Metro North and paying for food and getting around. And like, she was like, you need to ask Johnny for a Metro card. Like, you don't have to ask him for money or anything. Just ask him for a Metro card. And I was shook. And I asked him, he was like, oh, you've been paying for all that? He's like, yeah, I got you. He had no fucking idea. He gave it to me right away. But no, I was very much unpaid for many, many years. And even all my first beats went completely unpaid.
Outside of the networking, what would you say was the most important thing that you learned during that period?
Most important thing I learned in that period was just troubleshooting. I would get sent off to drop a check off at a certain bank and then go meet somebody at a studio and then go pick up some piece of equipment and then bring it back to some other location. And somebody gave me the wrong address. I don't have the routing number for the bank account. This train got fucked up. And then I had a family emergency in the middle of it. And when you're young and somebody's manager or an artist or a rapper you really like, whatever, gives you a shot and one of those things happens, you can't do the thing they asked you to do, you feel like it's over. You feel like, oh, they're never going to work with me. No one's going to work with me. The industry's going to blacklist me. Da, da, da. It feels like the biggest thing in the world. And so many things happened that were out of my control that it just opened me up to being in a gray area and not having to be like, this is how it's going to go. This is where I'm going to be. This is how my path will be. This is how my career will go. It opened me up to like, sometimes you're in a gray area and there's going to be days that are fucked up and years that are fucked up and times where you doubt your ability and times where you're not sure if you're even doing anything that's helping your career. And I had to be open to that to get into so much stuff I've gotten into since then. Because I was very regimented in my mindset when I was younger. And it was like, if this isn't going to make me money or help my career or further what I got going on, it's not worth it. And honestly, I probably turned down stuff even before then I shouldn't have.
When you're doing this internship, did you explicitly know that you wanted to be a producer? Or did you just know sort of broadly, I want to work in music or in the music industry?
I wanted to be a producer. Even back then, I felt like it was so oversaturated to try to come in via me making beats or being a producer that I knew the label internship, the job with the manager, being around the studio, that was the best way for me to kind of organically meet an artist and play my music instead of coming in and saying, what are the best odds that someone's going to give me a shot off of no placements, never working with anybody with a name, nothing in my, you know what I mean, on my resume. I didn't think people were just going to give me a shot to play beats. So I was like, if I'm the intern and everybody likes me, or I'm the person who's helping the manager out all the time and I get in cool with everybody and I got the best weed, sooner or later, I'm going to play a beat. And that's what happened. And I played that first beat and got a placement.
Interesting.
And then that person introduced me to Yams, who introduced me to Rocky, who introduced me to Arab Music, who introduced me to, and it just, that's how it went when I was younger.
Like Alchemist, the selling weed on the side thing seems to be like a recurring theme in idea generation producer interviews.
I'm not going to lie. Like, it'd be one thing. My mom knows it at this point. So I'm not, there's nobody I'm covering it up for.
It's legal in New York.
It's legal where we're sitting right now too. But like for me, it was always about creating value. And I knew that I have beats, but so do a million other people and a million people who've already proved that they're really good. So if I can maybe be the intern, or I can maybe have some weed, or I can maybe just be funny or just do something to make people want to be around me more than just that. Then I got two things going for me. And that turned into years later, learning to engineer, which turned into years later, now recording whole bands and doing the things I'm doing now. I just try to make sure that my skill set or what I'm bringing to the table is more than the person next to me. So I'll get the job. So even back then, it was like, how much shit can I do to ensure that someone will rap on my beat? But I only ever wanted to produce. I never wanted to do anything else.
So what was that major label versus totally indie scrappy style? How were you thinking about that? And were you drawn to one over the other?
Definitely was drawn to Johnny and like being in the rooms and being around the artists. And I didn't realize that the label wasn't like that. I was 17 years old when I got an internship out of high school. I had randomly went to kindergarten through senior year with someone whose dad was very prominent in the music industry. I didn't know that. And they told me, you should intern for my dad. And then I ended up at J Records. And Larry Jackson was there. John Eamon was there. Trevor Jarrett. So many people who have become legends in the music industry. And I was so fortunate to be around them. But I was getting coffee, answering phones, listening to demos, doing the normal rigmarole you do as an intern at a label. I saw Mike Posner walk by my desk one time. One of the big, like huge A&Rs had a chat with me once. It wasn't what I wanted to be around. And I knew I was trying to do this thing to get my foot in the door. So it wasn't going to be the most exciting. It was just going to be experience. But once I left that internship, I knew I had to go be around somebody who was in the thick of it, even if that was going to be more stressful or harder to do. Johnny was moving very fast. The days where Johnny was too busy for me to come intern, he would send me to this building called DD172 that Dame Dash was running. And I would go on my off days and help out at Dame Dash's spot. And that's how I met Ski Beats. And that's how I met so many other people who walked through those doors. And it was really just like the people that I got around who were really moving and shaking and in the studio and talking to the artists. That's when I realized, like, this is where I need to be. I can't help anybody in that boardroom with my taste as an A&R or all this music stuff I've done, trying to give somebody some insight into what artists to sign. I'm not here for that. I'm here to be around the artists to help them make whatever they're making, you know? And I realized that because of Johnny.
What was it like being around Dame as a 18-year-old in that moment?
Wild. Wild. Because you know it's Dame. I grew up on Dipset and Rockefeller, and I grew up on Jay-Z and all these things, and you know who Dame is. You know what I mean? It's not like it was a music industry person. Someone had to tell me their name. Like when I met Peter Edge or something, and someone's like, this guy is why Alicia Keys. You know what I mean? I knew who Dame was. I knew Jay-Z and all these people were spawning from this thing that he ran. So when I met Dame, he was in this different era of his career where he was starting Creative Control with Kuti and Chike, who just did the Kanye documentary. They were the people filming every single thing that happened in that building that I was in. I met Kuti and Chike when I was 18. Like, Dame was such a, like, important person in the music industry, and to be standing right next to him and hearing his ideas off the cuff and this and that, it made me feel like I was somebody, to be real. Being around somebody like that who was so influential in your childhood, even, it just makes you feel like it's panning out. It's like I said, it's another confidence boost. Just being in the room made me feel like I gotta keep doing what I'm doing. I gotta keep working harder.
Taking his education out of the tri-state, Kenny attended the Berklee College of Music in Boston. Initially, he was concerned about leaving the New York music scene just as he started to catch some momentum, but once he got settled in Beantown, he flipped the challenge into an advantage. You have this natural momentum, you're starting to make moves, you haven't quite gotten to the place where you're like really making music per se, but you're making the connections, you can feel that things are breaking in the way that you want them to.
Yeah.
And in the middle of that, you have to go to Boston. What was that feeling like?
I was mad at my mom. I was like, I remember trying to explain even to her, just like, mom, you don't understand who I'm hanging around with. Cause she just had she couldn't really fathom. My dad could semi get it. I'd show him a video of a rapper and then show him a picture of me next to that rapper. And he'd be like, oh, okay. But my mom didn't get it. And I remember I had this session and Yams came and Yams asked me for some beats. And I sent Yams like two or three beats. He called me like a couple days later and was like, oh, we're using these, da, 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 da. And I was like going to orientation the day after. And I remember leaving and being like, ASAP Rocky's about to rap on my, you have to understand, this is like Peso, Purple Swag. Like, this is the middle of it. Like, my favorite rapper, the hottest artist in New York City, maybe the world in this moment. And I'm about to go do orientation with these assholes. Like, I was so mad because I really was in the thick of it. And I got to Boston, and really my only interaction at that point was whenever I could get home for a weekend and get back around the people and hope they remembered me from all these internships and all these studio sessions, or try to reach out to someone on their one weird tour date in Boston. Ended up having this weird thing where whenever TDE came to Boston, or whenever ASAP came to Boston, or whenever Danny Brown came to Boston, or whenever certain artists that I had maybe met or knew someone who knew, or knew a producer who knew them, when they got to Boston, I go bring them some weed, go hang out, whatever. That's how I got a beat to Schoolboy Q. You know what I mean? That's how I worked with Danny for the first time. That's how me and Absol worked for the first time. That's how Mac Miller ended up on something of mine. That's how I met Mac, how I met Anwar, how I met so many people, was these people were on random one-stop shows at the Middle East in Boston, or House of Blues, or one of these venues. And someone I knew might've known them. I go by, bring some weed, go say what up, maybe play a beat, maybe end up talking about music. I had this weird little island in Boston where, yeah, I'm going to school, I'm sick of it, I'm taking tests, this and that. But once in a while, I'd get to have a solo one-on-one interaction with an artist who I could never get like that kind of time with in New York City. I'd be in a studio with 10 people, at a show with 20 people backstage. Like, maybe you dap someone up, maybe they remember your name. Now, these people knew me. You know what I mean? Like, Danny, I remember Danny Brown brought me to his sound check for the Childish Gambino tour. And I'm sitting there with Danny, and I'm like, being in Boston gave me this like weird little zone to kind of meet people and interact in my own kind of ecosystem without all the mess around it. And it grew a lot of relationships for me. So there definitely was a loss of me being able to be in the mix, but at the same time, I used it to my advantage.
When you got those first placements, the smoke dizzas and things like that, you weren't really being very buttoned up about the business side of things. Is that what motivated you to major in business at Berkeley?
I'm learning it as we're going. I would read something in class and I'd be like, perpetuity. And I go, look, oh my God. I remember there was one day I left Jeff Dornfield's class. It was a management class. I went home and looked at my contract for a beat that I just like signed in the media center at Berkeley and faxed back to like whatever iStandard or some fucking company. And I had given away all the rights to the beat for the rest of my life and all of the publishing and everything. And it was worded so convoluted and such lawyer contractual jargon that there was no way for me to understand that. You're not going to read into it that deep. So I remember being in class and realizing in class how not buttoned up my business was, and like slowly having to just like ask more questions every time someone wanted a beat from me. Oh, can I get publishing on this one? Like, it was really all happening at once.
So at what point did you start to like tighten up those things and get a manager and get a lawyer?
It wasn't till I left making rap beats and started doing a completely different style of music with a whole different thing in mind. I was a senior at Berkeley and my friend had dropped out and moved to LA, started sending me clips of DJs like Bauer and like RL Grime and stuff. And they were just making instrumental music with trap drums and putting it on SoundCloud. My boy's like, yo, they're killing these shows. I just went to the show last night, 5,000 people watching Bauer, blah, blah, blah. I just made this beat for Schoolboy Q. And everybody was telling me it sounded like EDM. It sounded like the sounds I was using weren't rap sounds. So I started making beats with my friend and we put them on SoundCloud. Within a week, getting hit up by agents, managers, all the stuff that never happened when I was younger. They all wanted this new sound because I was a part of this subgenre that had just gotten hot. The idea of dance music with the rap sounds was this new thing. My homie who was back in LA knew enough people to send the demo around. We knew some people who worked at Mad Decent. We might've known just a couple homies who like were actually doing well themselves, who might've played the records. And through word of mouth, within the first week, people were reaching out to us. And we kind of ended up being that second wave of producers behind Bauer and Floss and those kind of guys. And all the stuff that I wish had happened to me when I was younger happened when I started making this thing I wasn't sure about. And those years to me now are the years that like I speak about the least I always crack jokes about them in interviews and stuff because I started making this genre because people were like, yo, you should really do this. And I was leaving Berkeley, didn't have a label job set up. The money I was making on weed or beats or anything was not enough to go pay rent. And this seemed like the most viable way to take my talent and do something with it. And so getting all that attention immediately from, like you're saying, a manager, all these people who want to help me with the business and get me shows, that made me feel like I was moving the right way because it was happening. But then years into it, I started feeling this disconnect of, I never grew up listening to Skrillex. I'm not someone who, you know what I mean, has Daft Punk posters on my wall. This isn't what I feel in my heart the way I do when I work on rap stuff or work on pop stuff or anything else. And so those years helped me learn about business and production and get myself right as a businessman and a person in this industry. But I learned it all via this thing that wasn't really my thing. So that's the embarrassment in talking about it now. It's like, I feel like I was faking the funk for a couple of years. I was kind of just doing the thing that worked instead of fighting the good fight to do the thing that, like, I feel in my heart, I feel in my stomach.
What was the nature of sort of the creative partnership between you and Ryan?
He was the informational side of it. He taught me about electronic music, what the sounds were, how people produce those songs. You need a build up here. You need an intro here. The intro has to be just drums so you can mix songs into it. And I was just kind of like a production nut and it would make anything. I have a million sounds. I could do whatever. So you point me in any direction, I would just go. And yeah, I think we got to a point where I was really just not feeling it and not feeling the music we're making, the culture, the scene, the shows, the everything. And Ryan didn't want to make music anymore. And so I said, let me go. I'm about to do my thing. And I went and did my thing. And that's the last 5 years. I really got to a point where I looked back on 4 or 5 years of making music. And I'm like, I don't like this music. This relationship doesn't make sense anymore between me and my homie. This is how people know me. It's not Kenny Beats, the young kid who did that Kendrick beat. It's you are DJ. You know what I mean? For me to not only flip the music I'm making, go out on my own for the first time, really try to do rap production. You know what I mean? After this many years later, it felt insurmountable. And it was like the hardest moment I got. I was in huge debt from commissions I owed. I was the most miserable I've ever been in my entire life. And I just realized that, like, that amount of time I had spent those early years, I wonder if I had not just done whatever the thing that worked was, the easiest thing was, gone and done this genre of music that I didn't wholeheartedly feel. I wonder, would I have got to this faster? Would I have been talking to you 3 years earlier? Would I have been producing with Rick Rubin when I was 24 instead of 27? Does that matter? I don't know, but I think about it. And those years, like, they bug me because I always wonder if I moved how I'm moving now, what it would be like. So my instruction to people is always just, do the thing that you love the most and you know you love and your friends love, not the thing that is the easiest is going to work right now. Because then you're just like people who chase hits and you're in music for money or clout. You're not in it for art.
In that 4 year period, you guys reached a certain level of acclaim. You got the drums on the Bieber record. You got the Chainsmokers remix that was huge. And you built a brand in Lab Pack. Was it hard in any way for you to walk away from having put all of that blood, sweat, and tears into building something that had that resonance?
Not for a second. I've never listened to one of those songs since the day I shut the social media down. Not once. I never will. It doesn't do anything for me in any nostalgic way. It only makes me feel bad about not keeping it real with myself. We had acclaim and we had moments that, yeah, it's hard to walk away from something because you don't know if you're going to get lucky twice. If you've already been able to get an agent, a manager, make a lot of money, go around the world, do all these things. Quitting all that just feels dumb from a instinctual perspective because you're like, what if this doesn't happen again? I left everybody. I left everybody in that same time. I left my manager, my agent. I left everybody. Years before I stopped DJing, I was trying to start doing the Kenny thing. And I wasn't actively doing a lot of sessions or sending beat packs out, but I was saying to my team and to the people around me, my friends, I think I want to get back to making beats. I think I want to get back to like working with artists instead of being an artist. And the way people I was working with at the time reacted to it and what their plan, game plan was and stuff, I just knew it wasn't it. And when I was at my lowest, lowest of lows of my entire life, my best friend started managing me. And Mike is still my manager, who I run Don't Ever Think Shit with. And we run a company together that we share. It's a 50-50 company. It's not a manager running the Kenny Beats company who gets a little percentage. Like, me and Mike do things together. This is my best friend. And he started working with me at a time where no one believed that I could do it. And he looked me in my face. I couldn't have been more depressed at the time. He looked me in my face and said, "You're going to be one of the biggest producers. You're going to be a great, legendary producer. I know it."
After his stint as an EDM DJ, Kenny had to go back to basics to get in touch with hip-hop's evolving sound. That meant research and work to figure out what was moving the crowd and how he could emulate it. And once he did that, he had to begin reaching out to artists and just start making songs. Have you ever had a big idea but lacked the tools to implement it? Look no further than Shopify. Shopify is the brand that powers all your favorite clothing, beauty, and sneaker brands and offers the best-in-class commerce tools to allow you to sell online, in person, and on all major social platforms. Shopify fuels millions of entrepreneurs and turns ambition into action. Check out shopify.com/idea to learn more. Now back to the story. So you come to this point of inflection that you describe as a low point, and you decide to pivot and go back to making hip hop beats. What is step one, day one, to start building towards that?
You know nothing. That's what I would tell myself. I feel like years of me producing stuff that got a lot of plays and did really well, and even having worked with rappers in the past and produced for Ferg and Q and Mac and da 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 da, I think there was an inclination to kind of be like, well, I've done this. I've been doing this for years. I've been producing since I was 15. Let me just get back into it, see what the sounds are right now, what the vibe is right now, just make some stuff that feels like it'll work. And real quick, after just like earnestly spending a couple of weeks focusing on really just trying to make stuff for artists, my beats were ass. And I was listening to them and I was producing stuff at the time I was extremely proud of, but it was in this other world that I had been working so hard on. But my production technical ability was better than it was ever been in my life. And I started trying to make rap beats again, and they just felt stale. I knew they weren't right. I knew the drums didn't hit right. I knew the energy wasn't there. And step one was just learning. I invited anybody and everybody to this horrible little studio I was renting in like some weird area in Burbank. And anybody I could get to come there, I would invite. Young producers, any artist, unknown, someone I'd known from my past, someone who hadn't seen me in 5 years, me and Mixed by Ali hung out for the first time since I was younger. Like, anybody I could get to come there, I would invite. That was the cave. I would just slowly start to learn from like someone like Big Head, who was doing all of Lil Pump stuff at the time and Smoke Perp and this and that. And then maybe I'd get someone from Atlanta who was in town who might have known me from social media, and then they come through, and me and Ducko would make beats, and he was signed to Eardrummers, and he would kind of show me what was going on over there with drum sounds or the beats they're making. And I just tried to re-educate myself from every type of producer or artist or everyone around me. What do I need to know? And a lot of the time it's me who's co-produced with Skrillex and done all this big boy stuff, learning from a 17-year-old who doesn't know how to pitch a sample or doesn't know how to do like the most basic thing in production, but they are the sound right now. They know something I don't know. And just entering into that kind of thought process of, you are not from these parts of the country where these types of production are starting. You don't understand this slang that's happening in all these different places that you don't grow up. You don't know how he's doing that hi-hat, even if it sounds like you do. You don't know what 808 that is, even if you think that's the 808 that it is and you can program it just like that. I had to see it in front of me from the people who are really doing it, because I'm not authentic to any of that stuff. And to enter back into the scene, I didn't want to feel like I was playing people fake versions of something that they really wanted. I wanted to make the closest to the real thing, the closest to something that these artists would hear and instantly just love. And I had to start from square one.
When one looks at your discography, it's kind of like a exponential growth that happens from like 2016 to 2018, where you go from having a handful of placements to having like 75 placements in 2018. How did you engineer that?
It was that model I was just speaking about, never stopped for years. Anybody who wanted to come make music would come make music. And I was at that studio 16 hours a day. No one is coming. If no one wants to work, I'm making beats nonstop. If someone wants to work, I'll make anything they want to make. Like, I just, as artists started to want to work with me and they knew they could come work for free, I'll make any beat you want to make. There's always something to drink, some food, some weed there. And it's 24/7 anytime you want, as long as there's no one else there. It became a place where Key got really comfortable. Rico got really comfortable. Freddie Gibbs got really comfortable. Vince started coming by all the time. You know what I mean? Like, all these people that you see me working with in those years, and people were still some of my closest collaborators, I was a one-stop shop where your label didn't have to pay any money. You didn't have to pay any money. Anybody was allowed. Any amount of guns and drugs and whatever kind of bullshit. My studio was just the zone. It was things that didn't feel like the biggest things back then. But now when I tell the story, now when I say it was Thundercat left right before Young Dolph got there, right before, I don't know, like Doja Cat was leaving or something. People hear it now and it's Doja Cat has 66 million monthly listeners. You know what I mean? Young Dolph is an all-time legend who we've lost, who is like this cherished person from Memphis forever. Thundercat is one of the greatest musicians alive, who won the Grammy this year and done Kendrick and Suicidal Tendencies and Erykah Badu. Like, these things were so unbelievably amazing to me that these people were even coming by, that I just was like, okay, whoever else, you bring whoever you want to bring and anybody who wants to come. And it just kept going and got to the point where I'm doing 20 songs in a week.
How are you staying afloat?
At first, there was a moment where I had less than $1,000 to my name, and I have a studio that costs about that much in rent. I have an apartment, I have a car, I help my family, I got phone bills, whatever. Don't have enough money to even pay this 1 month worth of stuff. And I had done a beat that got placed, and that one check came in just in time to make rent that month. And I put myself on some payment plans for some other stuff, and I barely made it. The month after that, one or two beats that I got $2,500 for, $4,000 for, came in. Maybe some old money from a show. Things were just barely carrying me by for months. But those people put me in a situation to where I could build from there, and where I could get out of that hole, and where I could, they believed in me so much and what I was going to do, that you got to understand, me not taking money for these beats or these studio sessions, these people believed in me. They really, really did, my whole team. And through that whole period, getting back on my feet wasn't as much the concern financially as it was career-wise. And then there were these moments where you don't get paid on beats, you don't get paid on beats, you don't get paid on beats, you do a whole album. You get paid for 10 beats. You know what I mean? And even if you're only making $5,000 a beat, $50,000 for me in that year is life-changing money. $50,000 for most people watching this is life-changing money. It paid off. And I'm lucky I made it by, and I had people who helped me navigate making it through those months with no money, because the only thing I needed to get paid for was apartment rent, food, studio. Besides that, fuck it. You don't need it.
It seems like you went from having a couple placements to then doing these full albums with Rico, Kud Juan Pablo, and Greedo, and then eventually Freddie. How did you decide that you wanted to start moving in that collaborative full album zone? And were you having those conversations with the artist at the front door, or was it kind of like, well, we just made 15 amazing songs, so...
It was never at the front door, and it's never something that I think of or bring up to this day. The first time it happened, I had made so many songs with someone that they said, all right, this is a you and me project. I'm going to wear the Kenny from South Park hoodie on the cover, and da-da-da. And I was just like, wait, what the fuck? Like, first of all, don't wear that hoodie. But second of all, my name is going on the project? Like, and the artist just said it. I remember calling Mike and being like, yo, they said it's my project too, and my name's gonna be on. I'd never even fathomed that. I'd never thought about that. And now looking back on it, so many producers who have 10 times more Drake, Kanye, whatever, giant placements than me, they come to me and they say, how do you do those full projects? How do you end up getting your name tagged on Spotify as an artist with the artist? Like, it doesn't make sense to people. And it didn't make sense to me at first either, because I just thought, even if I do a bunch of songs for someone, maybe you get called an executive producer. I never thought about being tagged. I never thought about my name being on the cover. Rico did it. Freddie and Lambo, when they put out that project, they put my name in every press blast. When I did FM for Vince, I remember going to tweet, number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, produced by Kenny Beats, whatever it was. I did 10 beats on there. Instead of doing that, Corey, Vince's manager, goes to me, don't worry about sending the tweet this time. And I was shook because I was like, how am I going to get my credit? No one's going to know I did this. I was so used to like either the artist giving me some credit or me having to go tell people what I did. Vince had headlines in Rolling Stone and everywhere. Vince Staples and Liszt, Kenny Beats. Sometimes people have taken care of that for me and just put my name along with all the other important info they send out. I've been blessed in that way. And I think the reason is because people have found a home in these places we're working and these albums we're working on. They're seeing me every day for months talking about everything in their life, everything in my life, and we're making all these songs. When the project finishes, I think people have put it in my head almost that this is your project too, because I still will never say that. I'm not someone who feels like the music I make with people is equal parts their music and my music. If you're telling a story about your life or someone you lost or love or something, and I'm here to help you tell that story, each one of those lyrics doesn't hit for me the same way it hits for you. You know what I'm saying? So when people started including me in the narrative, like Isaiah does a Fader cover story and says, I learned how to rap again at the Cave. People don't have to do that. You know, and they did, and they decided to give me the credit. So to this day, every time it happens, it's because someone decides to do it. I've never asked or said that.
Kenny Beats is known for being incredibly flexible sonically. His goal is to help artists that he works with bring the ideas out of their head and into real life. And he's comfortable adjusting his sound to fit. Kenny says that often the most consequential thing he can do as a producer is just create a hospitable environment and then talk it out until the songs start to come into focus. A lot of young producers, when they're thinking about getting into the game and starting their careers, they're focused very myopically on the music. But when one looks at your discography and thinks about how you've built your career, so much of it is about more ephemeral traits and things that you bring to the table outside of just what you bang out on a drum machine. How do you think about creating that environment and setting that table for artists?
I think the way I've always thought about it is trying to help someone make either their best work or help them have the most fun. It's just about setting up a relationship with me and the person, setting up an environment, setting up collaborators that make it so every time that person even speaks or says one word, it feels amazing. I want to set people up to where when they say something on the mic, they love how they sound. Whenever they walk into the room, they just love everything they're looking at in every corner, whether it's my action figures and cool little synths and custom painted stuff and whatever it is, or if it's just having their best friends around. I was here with Rico last night. Her son is watching Netflix show, playing with my Nintendo Switch. You know what I mean? Her mom's on a call hanging out. Her and I are in there writing a song. She wrote an unbelievable song last night, along with the engineering side. Everybody hates how they sound. When I listen back to this interview, I'm gonna go, oh, that's my voice. When anybody hears themselves on a voicemail, they go, that's what I sound like? Artists feel the same way. Adele feels like that. You have to understand that setting up someone to feel cool or sexy or talented or smart or whatever can unlock something in creative geniuses that is unparalleled. You know what I mean? It's like if you can make someone feel like they're really good at what they're doing, they're going to do things you never even knew they could do. And if you've made people feel like you're really helping them out or feel really excited about what they're doing, they're going to try to do it for you. And a lot of artists have done it for me. They've showcased my charisma through their platforms. And that's led me to having a fan base.
Do you have a tried and true process to creating songs, or do you have to adapt to each artist or each talent?
It's completely different every time. If it's a trash talk session or a Khalid session, it's just going to be polar opposites. The only thing that I would say is my process every time with every artist is just questions. I ask a lot of questions. What do you love right now? What are you listening to? What's your favorite thing you've made recently? What's up with you outside of music? Those four questions can get you really far.
As a producer, you sort of have to balance, on the one hand, being an artist yourself. On the other hand, coaching a highly sensitive person. How do you navigate that?
I'm a highly sensitive person too. I think I understand it. I work with so many people whose minds are not normal, and that's why their art is not normal and their songs are so fucking good. It's because they're not like everybody else. There's so much music and so much saturation that that person who's extra sensitive or harder to work with or might be complicated to get in a conversation with, that's almost where I get the most excited. I think whenever I stopped trying to like be the quiet person in the room or be the producer or speak when the producer speaks and just being Kenny, that's whenever the people that you would think you can never relate to, that you need to be cool around or you need to not say that thing. Once you say that thing, it opens it up. I remember talking to an artist about something with my parents that was fucked up. And they looked at me so crazy. Like they had never really given me anything other than like a, hey, what's up? Cool. Yeah, nice beat. And they looked at me and said, what did you just say? They were going through the same exact thing with their parents. I just navigate all that kind of stuff by not thinking of it as networking or not thinking of it as how do we get to the song? I just have a conversation with this person to get along. And if you can get along with somebody, you can make a record with them.
As Kenny got his footing in hip hop, he started to see the potential to grow his brand beyond transactional beat sales. But in order to do so, he would need to build a team first. So Kenny and his manager pulled together their most creative friends and began creating community-oriented products around his brand. Up first was his YouTube show, The Cave, and then establishing vibrant channels on Discord and Twitch. In 2018, you get a ton of placements. In 2019, you really seem to conspicuously and consciously pivot your brand to the forefront of how you were presenting. And you start The Cave and the Twitch and the Discord. Was there a light bulb moment that you made that conscious switch?
My friends are really smart. Like I said, my best friend's my manager, and Don't Overthink Shit is a company of my five best friends. So Mike's my manager. Dylan is also one of my managers, but does distribution and clothing. Used to do clothes for Chance the Rapper and Daniel Caesar and all these people. He's our merch person. We have Dom, who's a creative director, who's done artwork for Party Next Door and designed crazy things you couldn't imagine. And now is who's there for all of our creative. We have Aris, who films The Cave and edits The Cave and does the Twitch animations and everything in between. All of these people, Drew, who does the animations, Jams, like who keeps everybody together, these people create that value around me. If I told you that something like The Cave or treatments for music videos or artwork for albums were things that crossed my mind all the time, I'd be lying to you. I'm focused on music and artists and producing and educating. Those are the things where I strive and what I love. My friends feel that way about design.
How did you assemble that team?
Mike. These are all friends that we kind of know, mutual people, people from different circles. And there's sometimes where Mike goes, hey, you remember Dom? You remember Dylan? I'm going to have them try a logo. Or I'm going to have them just come and take some photos of this session. And it started with things like that. Or it would be completely random. And Mike would say, this guy's part of the squad now. And when it's a group of five close best friends or three close best friends or whatever it was at the time, and someone says to you, this guy's part of the best friends now. You're like, whoa. We don't know them. What if there's another person who does their job better? Da, da, da. We are this team of people who at one time were just like cool acquaintances and now have built this thing that everybody can share in. These guys get work from other people because they see stuff that I might be working on, ask who worked on it, realize that the producer's team brought the treatments and the artwork and all the stage production for the artist. When has that ever happened? I present this whole team of people with everything I'm doing, whether it's a thing for me or I'm going to an artist to help them outside of the beats and the music, where we do clothing, we do designs, we do shows, we do live events, we run digital communities like the second biggest Discord in music. Having a team of people around me allowed me to be so much more than what they allow producers to be. And I think the advice in that is your friend who might just be the friend right now who is the cool one or the one that has a lot of good taste, or you have another friend who just is really good with money and always working on something and starting a new idea. This might be your team. That might be a manager. That might be a creative director. That might be someone who's running business for you in some way down the line. And right now it just feels like an acquaintance. When my cool homies became my business partners, Kenny Beats went like this. Don't Overthink Shit as a company is also doing this. But the point is me making beats, having some design ideas and doing content here and there by myself would never have gotten me to the point that I'm at now where I have all this value to brands and companies and different people outside of me being a producer. That's because they see what I can do on top of making beats on these albums and getting platinum records or whatever it is, produce all this content, start these communities, throw sold out shows in Central Park. My friends are that team. The team is what allows me to do that.
The Discord, for example, tell me the story of how this gets presented to you. How do they sell you on it?
I think the first time it even comes into frame for me is random DMs from supporters or fans just being like, yo, Kenny, come into this Discord. And that's the first time I saw the name. And it was like, yo, Kenny, come into this hip hop Discord or producer Discord. And there's a lot of things you'll see when you go on that app that are just categories. There's a musicians Discord. You know what I mean? It's crazy to say the Kenny Beats Discord is bigger than the musicians Discord at this point. But when we got on there, people were just like, yo, come on this website. All the people who are watching your stream all the time and are really interested in that community or the cave, this would be like a place for them to go 24/7. And maybe they could start their own little shows or little things together, or collaborate or whatever. It's just, that was how it was presented. It was, this can be a place for people who are in those comment sections to have a comment section 24/7. We still have no plans in monetizing it, but the idea of how you could or any of that never crossed my mind. None of those things. When I knew it was way more important than records I'm making, plaques I'm getting, producer stuff I'm doing, was when I asked a simple question when I was on Twitch one time and I said, hey, what is that sound in that beat? Within seconds, they had given me the sound in my Discord. They just said, here it is. I realized I have a hive mind of people from around the world that are focused on music, on production, on all these different ancillary details that I can't be focused on 24/7, but they educate me. It was supposed to be this, you can go in here and talk about Kenny Beats and Kenny Beats will make a beat and show you guys how to do it and talk about some story from his career. And it became them teaching me the zeitgeist of production, what's really working now, what sounds are going on, what actually things I thought were happening, what are really happening. Because you have 123,000 people in there as we're talking. I have that many producers I can ask a question to right now. If I say to them, do you think this is the sound for next year? Do you think this artist is going to do well? In all the chat rooms you guys are in, how do you feel about the temperature of this song or whatever it is right now? What A&R meeting has that much data? Like what label that's sitting down together to try to judge what they're going to buy or sell for the next year has 123,000 opinions? Or the 6 degrees of that, each of them are reading 20 comment sections. This hive mind now is a true kind of power, and it's a different kind of platform than my other social media, where it was explained to me as just a place where people could congregate and talk about similar things. And now it's a place where kids have gotten signed to major labels without paying me a single dollar, all because everyone in the Discord said they're hot. This was one kid, 16 years old, DVR. He made 4 demos on a version of Ableton, the free version. You didn't pay for it. You can't even save your work. He made 4 songs. He put them in the Discord. Hundreds of kids said, this kid's the one, this kid's the one. I'm getting calls from Polydor, from XL Records, from Atlantic. Kid signed to XL Records. He's on the same label as Adele and Radiohead and all this stuff. And he came out of the Discord, made some free songs. Never paid me a dollar. When people see that, that's power. Me signing 20 producers and making little publishing off them, that's not game-changing, world-changing. These kids are turning it into a thing where if everybody in here says you're good, you're on. That's unbelievable to me. I still can't even fathom that it's real.
How has the implementation of these community or media products transformed the business of Kenny Beats?
I think in the past, when you think about what a producer could do when it comes to a branding deal, a marketing deal, something outside of the scope of your music money, merchandise, maybe you speak for a product, maybe they help you get encompassed in something that a bigger company is doing with a bunch of musicians and you run the show. There's not that many avenues where producers can get paid, where a lot of different producers can get paid regularly that aren't just producing or maybe having the small fan base you sell things to. The business of Kenny Beats changed whenever we had a digital community with YouTube or Discord, where we're showing 700,000 people followed my YouTube the first year I started it. You know, like our Discord became the second biggest Discord in the music category the year we started it. I've now become a person where if you're having a label meeting about technology for young musicians, I'm in the convo. So if you want to talk about it in just regular layman's terms, the bags that come across our desk now are to consult for a major company or to come in and help someone review products to see if people in the music making landscape are going to really react to this because they know that hive mind is sitting in a Discord with my name on it. And I'm not saying we're the biggest thing in music or anything like that, but I am saying for an app that most people couldn't even describe to you what it is, that's become something that has made up the importance of what I'm doing with my life and my platform and everything, and also become the most creative thing that I'm a part of. Because really, what is the span for a producer is make the best music you can your whole life. You know, with the Discord, we're helping millions of more people make music and get better at it and not give up on it. And I've found that like, I'm not the only one who sees that. My team's not the only one who sees that. Just those labels that sign that kid for my Discord aren't the only one that see that. Bigger companies see that. And the conversations for, hey, Kenny, do you want to hold up this product or put your song in Fast and Furious versus help us build the digital community? It's not even the same scope. You know, it's a completely different thing.
With an unprecedented number of placements under his belt and a mobilized and highly engaged audience in tow, it was time for Kenny to start getting aggressive with the expansion of his brand.
In terms of percentages, like when you look at the business in 2021 versus 2020, what clip are you growing at?
We're growing. Here's how I look at it, even more than like a percentage on a year basis. Mike is someone who, he's one of those friends who like will say this thing that sounds crazy. He's like, yo, in 15 years, like we should start our own music festival. And then next to it, we'll have the label. And then if you go to the festival, you have a chance to get, like, he'll say these things and you're like, all right, Mike, cool. Like, yeah, in 20 years, we'll do that. He said all these things when Dots started of, we want to try to do this. We want to try to do this. We want to try to do this. Seeing those things start to be real conversations when years ago it seemed as crazy as Mike saying we're going to start the next Disney World, that's how I judge how fast we're moving or how much the business is growing. Remember, I'm a producer. For a producer to sell tickets for a show, maybe Mustard, maybe Mike Will, maybe certain people, you know, you can bring people out, but they have huge, massive hit songs, 20, 30, 50 hit songs. They can play a whole hour of just hits. That's why you get the Vegas residency, because you have hits. We threw a show in Central Park for 5,500 kids a couple of weeks ago, or maybe a month ago. And the next play from that is to do something for 7,000 or 8,000 kids. And the next play from that, you know what I mean, is to do something that's 10,000, 15,000 people. And when Mike said to me a couple of years ago, like, oh, we're going to throw a festival, that sounds fucking crazy. You know, you think about a Coachella, a Bonnaroo, whatever, you're like, how does that money work? Setting up stages? If you're going to throw a cool festival, there needs to be all these things to interact with and all this stuff. So how the fuck can we do that? We're barely going to start a YouTube show. And to see the conversations that we're having now with what Dots is able to do, the fact that we can give a producer $20,000 in a clip, we've given away $250,000 on Twitch. Like, what we're able to give back and what we're able to do is showing me the percentage of how the business is growing, because not only are my best friends not making $1,000, $2,000 a month anymore, they're making real deal salaries like they work at big companies. That's how I judge it. I judge it on the fact that we go to book people to go throw a show for us, and we're able to book acts that are bigger than me to come play a Don't Overthink Shit show for this eclectic community. And then we're having big promoters come to us and say, how do we build that out to this thing that we can bring across the country and across the world? Honestly, just like faith in doing the shit that we love with the people we love has proven successful. You look at the first season of The Cave, there's like 3 Grammy nominated people on that season that got nominated the following year. If you look at like, even like Doja, like Moo was out at that time. She's the biggest pop star in the world now. You know what I mean? It's like, we've worked with so many people for so long that now as these people grow, as we grow, as the business grows, we're able to do these things now that to me seem like a big deal. That's things like that aren't for me. You need a company to do it, you know?
So when you look at 2022, 2023, what are the goals that you have?
I think the goals are help as many people as far away as possible get excited and inspired. And that doesn't even necessarily mean music. If something that I'm doing with artists I'm working with, if Dots is doing for the community people that support us, anything that we're a part of, I'm hoping to just take people from the last 2 years of worry and doubt. And even while we're having this conversation, so many insane things are happening in the world that are affecting the community of people that I love, the people who make music, the artists, the whatever. I want to make sure that along with continuing my personal path of making more music, making better songs, making great art, I help more people make more art and more people that feel like, on top of social unrest, a pandemic, the saturation in 2022, the world ending and the music industry being in the worst place, I want to make people feel like there's still a spot to be great. And I think the music industry has killed so much of the best music. Bad contracts, too many people, wrong time, wrong place, da-da-da-da-da. If I can help someone realize that a Discord, a community of people banding together, a bunch of creatives all looking towards one thing can help more great music happen and more people who might have given up keep following it, that's my goal. And I used to think my goal was just making the best songs, you know? And these last couple of years, like all these things we're talking about have started to spiral into something where you think, what can you really do for music? Is it just add another song to the board? Because I love music. It's all I ever want to do, but it's as much my hobby as my job. I'm going to do it even when I'm not working. It's always going to be there. I'm never going to be businessman, Tony Robbins, Gary V, Kenny, you know what I mean? And then talk about when I used to make records. I'll make records till I die, but I want to give that feeling to as many people as possible.
Kenny Beats is a unique talent. In an industry driven by ego and ambition, Kenny succeeds thanks to his humility and hard work. By putting himself and his ideas in a supporting role rather than a competitive one, he's able to get the best out of the artist he works with. And his low-key, friendly vibes engender an audience that is tuned in to see him succeed. His interest in community building is authentic, and it elevates him and his brand far beyond any streaming data, as evidenced by his sold-out shows around the world. Kenny is a gifted musician with a golden ear, but his success lies in his people skills and his dedication to his craft. And though charisma can't really be taught, being kind and authentic and diligent can. We should all, on our best days, be striving to be like Kenny. Big thanks to our sponsors at Shopify. If you're looking to start your own online store, check out shopify.com/ideas and become your own boss today.